Okay, thank you very much. You'll excuse me, I'm a little jet lagged still. I just got back on Thursday from, I was in Prague and Israel and Rome. And just got back from Rome Thursday, so I'm still recovering, schlepping around Europe with 120 students. Schlepping anywhere with 120 students is enough to give you jet lag, and especially when it's in Europe. Anyway, the subject for this evening, entering the fold and leaving the fold. What I mean by this is the following, and I want to talk about it in greater depth, is there's a throughout history, there has always been Jews who have left Judaism. From the very beginning of Jews, we know that in Egypt, for example, the Midrash tells us that during the plague of darkness, it says 4/5 of the Jews died. There are some who would say it's metaphorical. They died as Jews and maybe existed as Egyptians. A very fascinating explanation I heard from a good friend of mine of, it says that Moses, when he went out, it says he grew up in the house of Pharaoh, and he went out and he saw his brothers being oppressed by the Egyptians. And it says he sees an Egyptian beating a Jew, and it says, Yifen Kovako, he looked this way and that way, Vayarki Amish, he saw there was no man, and he killed the Egyptian. Very interesting. What does that mean? He went out, he saw his brother, he looked this way and that way, saw there was no person, and then he killed the Egyptian. So this friend of mine explained it in the following way. He says, look, we're not taking away from the pshuto, the simple meaning of the verse, but he says maybe what it means is the following. Moses was brought up in the court of Pharaoh. That means he had a tremendous amount of identity and culture of the Egyptian court. Yet his mother brought him up in that house of Pharaoh. She was his nursemaid. So he had his mother, his Jewish mother, in the court of Pharaoh. So it says this, he came out of that court and he saw an Egyptian beating a Jew. So that means he saw one part of his background in conflict with the other part of his background. He says he looked this way to his Egyptian background, he looked that way to his Jewish background, and he realized if he doesn't choose one or the other, ain't ish. He's not a person. Right? Vayifen kovacho, he looked at his Egyptian past, he looked at his Jewish past, and he said, ain't ish. I'm not a person. Unless I choose one or the other. So what did he do? It says he killed the Egyptian. And he chose to be the Jew, and he left Egypt with that. So I think a very beautiful explanation. What it's saying is that there was a conflict here, and he resolved the conflict. He killed the Egyptian within, and he left that behind. But we know that that wasn't true of all Jews. That was not true of all Jews, and throughout history, there's always been a phenomenon of assimilation. We go back to the time of the Greeks, the Maccabees. We know that Josephus Flavius, the great historian, tells us that there were cities in Israel which were totally, 100% Jewish, but you wouldn't know it. You would go there, it would look like a Greek city. As far as you could see, all the Jews looked like Greeks, they ate like Greeks, they acted like Greeks, the city looked like a Greek city, you wouldn't know. Thousands of people in the city, no idea that it was a Jewish city. And so what happened to their descendants? Their descendants today are living somewhere on a Greek island drinking ouzo, right? And basically they're no longer Jews. We know that at later parts of history, whether it was the time of the Babylonians, when the Jews were in Babylon, many of the Jews intermarried. When they came back to Israel with Ezra, and not all the Jews, but some of the Jews came back to Israel with Ezra. We know that Ezra was very upset. I mean, he separated out. There were people who were intermarried. And there were people who were intermarried, and even at that time. So you had assimilation then. What happened to their descendants? Their descendants became Babylonians. So throughout history, there has been what we call Neshira, a dropping away, a leaving of the leaving of the fold. And what we haven't had throughout most of history is people coming back. That is a relatively new phenomenon. You know, I did a tour of Budapest for a group of students last year, and apparently in Budapest in the 1920s, there was one Baal Tshuva. There was a famous person, one Baal Tshuva. That means one person who'd brought up secular, as most Jews were in Budapest, very secular town, reform, no conservative, very little Orthodox community, and he'd been brought up reform, and He went to Poland. He fell in love with the Hasidic movement. He came back to Budapest looking Hasidic. His parents were, of course, distraught, right, in the entire community, but one Jew. So he had one person in Budapest who had returned to Judaism. One. Out of literally thousands of Jews who lived there. It was a very unusual phenomenon. I remember I used to teach at Or HaSamach in Jerusalem, and there was an elderly man who used to come and used to come to pray at the yeshiva. And I once asked him where he lived. We got into talking. He said he lived, you know, in the next neighborhood, Arzeh Habira. I said, why do you come to pray here? He said, well, I enjoy looking at all these guys who were once secular and have now come back to Judaism. He said, because when I was a kid in Russia, he says, I remember, he said, there was one person in our synagogue who was a Baal Tshuva. One person in the entire town, and people used to come and look at him. Ooh, that's the guy who came back to Judaism, right? And he says, it was a surprise, it was a shock to see such a thing. He says, I come to Or HaSamach and there's 200 guys in the Beit Midrash. 200 guys sitting there studying Talmud, people who were brought up totally secular. He says, it's a miracle to me to see such a thing. And indeed, it is a miracle to a great degree, anyone who comes back to Judaism. So that's a new phenomenon, people who have come back to Judaism. However, together with people coming back to Judaism, we have another phenomenon of the people leaving. But the people leaving Judaism, many of them are people from within, from deep within. People who have been educated in the yeshivas, people who have had a strong Jewish education, people who have had a strong Jewish past are leaving Judaism. I'll just give you some case histories here. I had a student, someone I know, who went to some excellent yeshivas, but he never quite fit in. And because he didn't quite fit in, thank you very much, right, because he didn't quite fit in, so there were people that, you know, he had social issues with people. He is now completely secular. Completely secular. Right? There are other people I know, a few people who were brought up in a Hasidic environment, and they look Hasidic. I remember talking to one. He came to a Gateway seminar a few years ago, Shavuot. I'm sitting there in the afternoon in the hotel lobby, fellow with a shtreimel, the fur hat, the whole works, right? Much, much more religious than I am, right? And he looks, and we're sitting down, and he says, you know, I don't believe in God. I said, you serious? He said, yeah. He said, in fact, I don't believe in anything. I said, well, why do you dress like that? He said, I like the lifestyle. It's okay. I like cholent, right? Do you know what cholent is in Georgia? Whatever. Okay. He says, I like Shabbat. He says, my children have a decent upbringing. He says, I don't believe in it. I said, do you have friends like yourself? He says, many. He says, I have many friends like this. Yeah, they look like me. Don't believe in anything. I had a student at a very famous yeshiva in Brooklyn, a 12th grader. He came to me and he said he was one of the top guys in Talmud in this yeshiva. Excellent, fantastic, brilliant mind. And he said, Rabbi, he says, I don't believe in a thing. He says, I enjoy the intellectual stimulation of Talmud. He says, I don't believe in a thing. And you know what? I get this all the time. People phone me all the time. I run into people at Gateway seminars. I run into people in different places. I get a lot of people who are telling me they're no longer part of Judaism, no longer want to be part of Judaism, no longer feel part of Judaism, even though they were brought up that way. So what's the problem? Why does this happen? I mean, I think there are multiple causes, and obviously every person is an individual case, but I think there are a couple of general ideas that we can learn from what is happening in these cases. Right? Number one, and I think it's important to note, at the end of last week's Torah portion, which we just finished, Bo, Nachmanides tells us a very interesting thing. Nachmanides tells us what is the reason for most of the commandments. 613, a lot of commandments, 613 of them. What is the idea, he says, behind the commandments? The Nachmanides says, he says, I want to reveal to you a reason behind most, if not all, of the commandments. And he says, it is one thing, what he calls emunah, which is belief in God, a relationship to the Creator. In fact, he says, that is the purpose of the plagues. Why did God have to do the plagues? I mean, you think about it. He wanted to get the Jews out of Egypt. God could have done two things. One plague, to smite the Egyptians, and then another miracle to get the Jews out. I mean, he could have, like, beamed them out of Egypt, beamed them into the desert, right? Put the phases on kill, goodbye to the Egyptians. That would have been it. Two plagues, right? One shot. Why did it have to go? Why this prolonged year of plagues? I mean, what's the necessity for all that? You ever wondered about that? I mean, why? It's like this, like, endless thing, you know? Like, we'll warn Pharaoh. We know what's going to happen. Like, we know what's going to happen, right? It's like one of these plays where you know exactly what's going to happen, right? Pharaoh's going to say, "Oh, okay, you guys can go." He's going to change his mind as soon as the plague's gone. There'll be another plague. What's going on? Nachmanides says the answer is very simple. He says because the Jews in Egypt didn't believe in much. He says the spark, as Maimonides puts it, he says the fire of belief in God that was lit by Abraham was extinguished in Egypt, almost completely extinguished. The Jews in Egypt were on a very low level. They were very assimilated. Very. They still had Jewish names. They still had Hebrew. They still had Jewish clothing, but ideologically, they were basically Egyptians. And the Egyptians themselves, obviously, were also lacked belief and denied many of the principles of belief in God. So God wanted to educate both the Jews and the Egyptians in belief. That is the entire purpose of the plagues. And if you look in the Torah says that. After the first three, God says, Laman, in order that you should know that I am God. Next three, God says, in order that you should know that I am God in the midst of the land. After the next three, in order that you should know that there is none like me. In other words, God tells us specifically why there is a plague. He says, in order that you should know. So the purpose of the plagues was basically to instill belief in the Jewish people. So the Jews and the Egyptians should know that there is a God and should have a relationship with him. What's the purpose? And Nachmanides says, since God doesn't do miracles like that all the time, he only does miracles very infrequently. He says, and he wants us to remember the beliefs that we saw with our eyes and we experienced in Egypt. Therefore, he gives us many commandments in order to continue to instill those beliefs in us. And Nachmanides says that's the purpose of getting together in synagogues. He says, why do we get together in a synagogue to pray? Wouldn't it be better to pray in the privacy of your own home, right? Just meditate quietly instead of being in the synagogue, right? He says the answer is publicity. It's a place we can get together and stand here and say, Bru'echa anachnu, we are your creatures. We are creatures of God. In other words, there's an idea, right, of relationship with the Creator is at the center of all the mitzvot. That is the purpose of the mitzvot, is relationship with the Creator. So, and that's something which I think to a great degree has been forgotten. I think it's been forgotten to a great degree. What for a lot of people has become something which is just cultural Judaism, whereby you do certain things, you eat certain types of foods, you look and dress a certain way, and that's basically it. But what it becomes is something which is very, very external. What we call in Hebrew, min ha-safa ul-chutz, from the lips outwards. Right, from the lips outwards. We have the prophets talked about the danger of mitzvot anashim melumada, which means the mitzvot of people who are just going along the path, like oxen used to have these things they'd put on their head to make sure they follow the path, right? So there are people who do the same thing, right? Really, the essence of the human being is to be a bocher, is to be a chooser, to make free will choices. Maimonides says in Guide for the Perplexed that when it says, B'tselem Elokim, that we were created in the image of God, what does it mean, the image of God? So one of the explanations he gives is, what it means is we have free will. A human being is essentially something, a being in this planet with free will. No other being has free will. Animals do not have free will. Animals do what they do because they have they're pre-programmed, they have instinct, and they react to things. That's all the animal does. It has no free will. Angels are called Chayot HaKodesh. What's Chayot HaKodesh mean? Holy animals. Yeshiva football team. Right? The holy animals. Right? Why are they called holy animals? Reb Chaim Volozhin says because they have no free will. They're holy in the sense that they're spiritual. They're animals because they have no free will. Only the human being has the ability to make choices, right? In the words of a great Hebrew poet, right? Regel achat birakia shvi'it, regel achat bishol tachtit, which means one foot in the seventh heaven, one foot in the depths of hell. Only that is a human being. One who is only capable of doing good, that's an angel. Not worth anything. Only capable of being morally neutral, that's an animal, not worth anything. Capable of great good, capable of great evil, that's a human being. Which means when we do actions which are not a consequence of our choice, it's not really very meaningful. The action that I do that's a consequence of my choice, that is meaningful. That is meaningful. So Rabbeinu Yonah, one of our great sages, in his book Share Tshuva, The Gates of Repentance, Rabbeinu Yonah says that aside from the obligation to do a mitzvah, aside from the obligation to do the mitzvot, the commandments, to give charity, to light candles on Shabbat, to all the various commandments, he says there's an additional component. There's a component which is to do the mitzvot because I choose. To do the mitzvot out of bechira, out of free will. In other words, when I do a mitzvah, to think about it, one of the reasons, by the way, that the sages established the obligation to say a blessing before I do a mitzvah, right? Why is there an obligation to say a blessing? So that we stop and think about it before we do it. Otherwise, we'd be completely automatic. There's a Tosfot, one of the great commentaries on the Talmud. He says there should be a blessing, there should be a blessing to our head for knowing when to bow, because otherwise we wouldn't remember ourselves. Right? Now it's because we're standing there praying, right? Thank God my head remembers that it has to bow, right? Because my mind certainly doesn't know, right? So we certainly, you know, you say it's like a reflex reaction, like a Pavlovian conditioning. I hear the word modim, I bow, right? That's how it is. Modim, aleinu, right, etc. We don't actually think bowing is an expression of yira, of fear of God. Actually, I was in Sfat 2 weeks ago with a group of students, so in the Arizal synagogue, I've got to mention this because I like this story. Right, in the Arizal synagogue, if you look opposite the door is the bima, like there's a door there, the bima is here, and there's a hole in the side of the bima. The bima is about this high, right? And on the there's a large hole in the side of it, which is made by shrapnel. During the 48 War of Independence, a mortar exploded right outside the synagogue, and a piece of shrapnel came through the door and hit the bima. Now, there's a guy standing there. He was standing right in front of the bima opposite the door. And as the shrapnel and as the bomb exploded, he bowed down for modim. And when he bowed down for modim, the shrapnel went over his head into the bima. Right? And if you look, you can still see the shrapnel, the hole in the bima from the shrapnel. People put little notes in there. And anyone seen it? You've seen the Arizal? Right. So I told the story to the students. There's an elderly man in the synagogue who looks like he could have been around in 48. Right? And he says, Sheker! It's a lie. The story's a lie. I said, oh my gosh, it's a famous story. He says, it wasn't modim, it was aleinu. Right? He was bowing for aleinu, not modim. So that was the guy who said, okay, you know, I was a little nervous at the beginning. But, so there is this idea, though, that it's almost so many things are automatic for us, right? So number one problem is that maybe to a certain degree our education system might be so good that we've created, in the immortal words of Uncle Moishi and the mitzvah men, we've created the mitzvah robot, right? But basically where you're pre-programmed to do a mitzvah without really thinking about it. I'll tell you a fascinating thing. There's a discussion in the Talmud whether mitzvot tzrichot kavana. Does a mitzvah, to fulfill a mitzvah, do you need to think that you're doing a commandment of God? And the conclusion, according to halacha, according to Jewish law, if you look in the code of Jewish law, the conclusion is that indeed the mitzvot do need kavana. They do need intent in order to fulfill the mitzvah. In order to fulfill the commandment, you've got to actually have some level of thought about it. And by the way, even according, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman points out that even according to those who say you don't need to actively think that you are doing a mitzvah, he says, but if you're not even aware that it's a mitzvah, you don't fulfill it for sure. But you have no idea, right? Imagine, like, I have a friend who owns a non-kosher French restaurant in Manhattan, where unfortunately a lot of Jews go. And he says he always puts matzah on the table during Passover, so they can have it with their escargot. Right, etc. Right. Anyway, I don't ask. I don't know why. But again, at least he puts matzah out. But so someone has gone to the French restaurant. It happens to be Seder night, and he eats matzah on the table. He says, "Oh, cool, there's matzah." Right? Is he fulfilling the mitzvah? Of course not. He doesn't even know it's a mitzvah. He has no idea. Right? Rabbi Sushard, director of Gateway, said he met a guy who's now currently the gabbai of a synagogue in Los Angeles, and he told Rabbi Sushard, he said, "You know." He said, what brought me to Judaism? And Rabbi Sushat said, no. He says, Metallica. So Rabbi Sushat, I'm fascinated. Please tell me. Right, Metallica is a rock group for those who are not familiar with it. Right? Okay. So anyway, he says he's with his girlfriend, not Jewish, and they're driving to a Metallica concert in the evening. What could be better? He's with his girlfriend in the car. It's a convertible. It's a beautiful evening in Los Angeles. The top's down. He says they're on the way to a Metallica concert. He says they stop. There's a police officer at a light. It's a red light. There's lots of people crossing. He stops at the red light. The light turns green. The officer stops the traffic and he tells more people to cross. So the guy's saying, yeah, we're already running a little late. He's getting a little nervous. Right. The light turns red again. Okay. More people are crossing. The light turns green. He's about to go. The police officer puts his hand out and waves more people across. He's like going, he says, this is unbelievable. He's out of his mind. He's already missed two lights. Right. The light turns red again. Finally, right, it turns green. There's two more people. The police officer stops him. He starts tooting. Police officer walks over and says, excuse me, sir. Do you not see me stopping the traffic here? Why are you blowing the horn? He says, well, this has been the third light. Where are these people? What are you doing here? We've got a light. Why are you? He says, the Hispanic police officer, he says, tonight, sir, is Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement. It's the holiest night of the year for the Jews. I've been given instructions to let the people cross as much as possible in order to get to the synagogue on the other side of the road. So you'll just have to wait and please not blow your horn. Now, this guy is Jewish. He didn't even know it was Yom Kippur. He's on the way to the Metallica concert right with his non-Jewish girlfriend. The Hispanic policeman tells him it's Yom Kippur. And that's why he's stopping the traffic. He said he hears this. He says a chill goes through him. And he says to his girlfriend, he says, honey, I'm sorry. I'm taking you back home. I'm going to go to synagogue. And he went to synagogue that night. And he's now committed to Judaism. He's a gabbai of a synagogue. So I don't know if it was thanks to Metallica or despite Metallica or thanks to the Hispanic. Maybe the Hispanic policeman was a Murano. I don't know. But either way, he has some merit from the Inquisition. But either way, but the fact is, in order to fulfill a mitzvah, you've got to know that it's a mitzvah. Right? And you have to know that this kavanah is very interesting. Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik said in his responsa, Beit Halevi, he has a discussion about the mitzvah, the obligation to give charity, to give tzedakah. Right? And he says, what about giving tzedakah? What if I give charity? Do I have to have intention when I give in charity? He says, now, there are those who say that a mitzvah, where when you do the purpose of the mitzvah is to establish a certain result. Look, even if I didn't think about it, the fact of the matter is the poor guy has still got the money. Right? He's got the money, doesn't he? And the fact that I didn't think about it doesn't take away from the fact that he's got the $10 or $5 or whatever it is you give. Right? So maybe in such a mitzvah where he anyway has the money, I've established the result. Maybe I don't need to think about it. Maybe I don't need kavanah. So he says that's a mistake. Because there's a famous story in which Turnus Rufus, who was a Roman, used to often debate the rabbis. He said to Rabbi Akiva the following, how can you give charity? How can you give tzedakah? Rabbi Akiva said, why not? Turnus Rufus says, I'll tell you why. He says, very simple. God's punishing this guy by telling him he's on a starvation diet. Right? God says, oh, right, this guy is going to be poor. That's his punishment. He says, you are sneaking him food. He says, does that make sense? He says, imagine, right, the government, whatever, some government puts some guy in prison. They're going to put him on he's in prison, hard labor, right, minimum calorie diet. Right, people pay to do that nowadays, but it used to be a prison sentence. Okay, right, so, you know, you go to a gym, you get hard labor, and you have someone, and then you have to tell a person how much you ate, and then they yell at you, etc., etc., like the gulag. Anyway, so what, basically, people pay to be in the gulag. So now, he says, so sometimes the king sentences him to this, and you sneak him food. He says, does that make sense? So Rabbi Akiva said, you're making two mistakes. Mistake number one, he says, you're assuming that the person's in poverty because it's a punishment. He says, not a punishment. God loves the poor. He says, it's not a punishment at all. He loves this person as much as he loves those who are not in poverty. Right? He says you cannot assume that poverty is a punishment, just as you cannot assume that wealth is a reward. Each one is a challenge for the individual to rise to that challenge. Some people fail the challenge of wealth. Some people succeed the challenge of poverty. Some people fail the challenge of poverty. Some people succeed in the challenge of wealth. He says the challenge is not a punishment. He says number one. And he says number two, you know why that person's poor? So that God wants to give you the merit of giving him the money. In other words, God could give him the money. God wants this guy to have $20. Do you think he needs you for the $20? Is there no way God could get $20 to this guy without you? Anyone thought of that? I mean, I give the guy $20. I say, not bad. Right? Look what Becher's done. But I think to myself, hello, isn't God capable of getting him $20 without Becher? Of course he is. Right? So why does he want to do it through me? The answer is, for whose benefit is it? Mine.
The giver.
It's right, the giver's benefit, right? Not the receiver's benefit, because the receiver could get it in any way. God could give it to him in 50 different ways, right? But how does he get it? He gets it through me. That means I get benefit. He says, however, if the primary, Rav Soloveitchik says, if the primary idea here is not the fact that he receives, but the fact that I give, he says, then guess what? You've got to think about it. He says, because it's not, the mitzvah is not fulfilled in the fact that he got $20. That's not where the mitzvah is. The mitzvah is that I gave. And if the main focus of the mitzvah is in my giving, then what does that mean, folks? What that means is, he says, I've got to think about it. It's got to be done with bechira. It's got to be done with free will. It's got to be done through choice. So we are losing that, and a lot of people have lost that. The idea of doing things as a result of bechira, doing things as a result of choice. A good friend of mine who lives in Toronto now, lives in Thornhill. Thornhill is a heavily Jewish neighbourhood in the north of Toronto. I lived there for 4 years. Heavily Jewish neighbourhood in the north of Toronto. The local supermarket, big kosher bakery, right? Kosher grocery, etc. This guy grew up in some small town in upstate New York. Small town upstate New York. He said there was no bakery there, they had to get it in from another town. He says there was no kosher grocery, etc. He said, you know, he often felt more Jewish there than he does in Toronto. Because in Toronto, he says, it's easy. Anywhere he goes, right, you'd have to actually look for non-kosher bakeries in Thornhill. Right, you have to go out, you know, you have to be a dafkanik, you know, you have to be a real evil guy. If you want to eat non-kosher thorn, you've got to like look for it, right? So he says, you know, the automatic thing is just and he says, and there's like four different synagogues you can choose from, etc. There's very little what he calls bechira. You haven't made much of a choice about the matter. It's just the norm. And that's something which can be problematic. That's something which can be problematic. So I'm not suggesting that everyone moves out to some hick town in New York State, right? I mean, but nevertheless, there is something to be said for someone to be aware of their Jewishness, right? Because you're in an environment which is totally not, right? You're more aware of who you are. You're more aware of what you are. You're more aware of making the choices. You know, you're on the plane, El Al, right, New York to Tel Aviv. New York to Tel Aviv, El Al, New York to Tel Aviv. So you can decide which minyan you want to go to. There's Sfar, there's Ashkenaz, there's one you don't daven in, right? There's the bathroom minyan right next to the bathroom. There's the one near the, there's the kitchen minyan, right? There's the emergency exit minyan. You've got a whole choice, right? I personally, when I'm on the plane, parenthetically, don't daven with the group. I don't like it. A, I feel it disturbs the people who are sitting down. They paid for a ticket. Why should they have me standing next to them, blocking the bathroom, right? That's not, I feel bad. I can't do it. It disturbs me when I'm doing it, right? So I don't, right? But you know what? It's easy, right? Go from New York to Australia. It's a little different. There's no minion. Usually I'm the only person on the plane with tefillin on. Right? And post 9/11, it looks weird when you've got, you know, from, you know, you're traveling in the Pacific area, they're not used to people wrapping, you know, you're wrapping boxes on your arm in the plane, right? People are looking at you, getting very nervous, right? You know, and then you put your shawl on, which they look as like, what is he putting on a shroud, you know, which we call a tallis, right? It's like people get very weird. I expect a SWAT team to come over to me any second, right? But the fact of the matter is, you think about it more. It's an opportunity to make a choice, right? Not everyone on the plane is eating kosher. They say, kosher, sir? He's like, yes, kosher here. It's a choice. It's a choice. And choice is so, so central. So I would say, number one, what we're missing a lot is the idea of bechira, is the idea of free will. And number two, we have less of a focus on emunah. We're less of a focus on emunah. We don't study it. For some reason, in our systems of education, very little attention is given to it. Very little attention, right? It is assumed that the child knows. I see in the siddur here, right, the Tfilat Raphael. So at the end of Shacharit, I believe with complete faith in the 13 principles of the Torah. I would guess if you asked most students in yeshiva high schools or seminaries today, what are the 13 principles of faith? Do you think they'd know them? I don't think so. I don't think so. Why are these so important? Maimonides, there was a lot of controversy, by the way. There are those who criticize Maimonides for saying 13. They say, what do you mean 13? You have to believe in everything in the Torah. Why only 13? There are some, like the Rabbi Yosef Alba, who said there's only three. Why 13? Well, a lot of, but the accepted view is Maimonides. We all accept the 13 principles of faith. Why are they so important? What is important about them? And especially Maimonides takes a very harsh view. You know, Maimonides says that if a person believes that God is physical, he's got a hand. So you look in last week's Torah portion, or this week's Torah portion, it says God took the Jews out of Egypt with a strong, an outstretched arm and a strong hand. Maimonides says, if you read that literally, he says you've denied a central principle of the Torah, and such a person is outside the pale of Judaism. So there are those who criticize Maimonides. The Ravid says, how can he call a person that? How could Maimonides be so strict? I mean, what, a person made a simple mistake. He read the Torah literally. He's a simple Jew, and he read the Torah literally. How can you blame him for that? You hear the problem here? Maimonides seems to be very, very harsh. He says, if you lack a belief in these 13 principles, he says, such a person is out of here. So the Ravid and others disagree. They say, how could you be so harsh? The guy is a simpleton. He's a simple Jew, right? He just read it literally. How can you blame him for that? You know, so how do we understand Maimonides? So I think the way we understand Hurt from My Teacher, the way we understand Maimonides is the following. The purpose of our being here is to have a relationship with God. Relationship requires knowledge about certain truths about the one with whom I have the relationship and denial of certain untruths about that person. For example, let's say I'm schmoozing with one of you. We're developing a friendship. But deep down, I believe that you are an alien from another planet. And when you get home, you peel off your mask like that, and underneath is this reptile. Can I have a normal relationship with you? I mean, I think it'll be a little rough, right? Wouldn't it be a little difficult? Or let's say I believe you've got multiple personality disorder. You know, you've got this Sybil, 16 personalities. You go to the psychologist, he charges you for group therapy, right? Let's say I believe that about you. I don't know which personality is. Can I have a normal relationship with you? Let's say it's not my fault that I think that. Let's say someone told me something about you. I believe them. I was misinformed. Is it still possible for me to have a normal relationship? Of course not. It doesn't matter why I don't know. It doesn't matter whether it's my fault that I don't know these things about you. It doesn't matter why I think that you're an alien or whatever it is. If I do think those things, there's going to be a barrier in the relationship. Isn't that clear? That's how Maimonides understands it. He says, what are the minimum things you've got to know about God and the Jewish people and the Torah in order to have a relationship with God? These 13 principles. If you don't know these 13 principles, he says, how could you have a relationship with God? You don't know with whom you're having the relationship. You don't know what it means. You don't know what the relationship is. Right? We have all types of distortions about it. He says, how could it be possible? You cannot have it. So that's how Maimonides would answer those who criticized him. He would say, I'm not assigning blame here. It's not a matter of blame. It's not a punishment. Right? Rather, it's a reality. The reality is that if I don't know certain truths about you, I cannot have a normal relationship with you. If I believe things about you which are totally not true, I cannot have a relationship with you. If I want to have a relationship with God, I've got to have, and wouldn't Jews have to little bit be philosophers? Right? A Jew's got to be a bit of a philosopher. I was in Rome on Thursday, where I did a tour of Rome. You know, it's amazing to me. You know, you look at all the Trevi Fountain, all the Bernini Fountains, all the beautiful artwork that was commissioned by the various popes throughout history, every single one of them has statues of Roman gods. Which is pretty, it's amazing, you know, when you think about it for a second, aren't these popes the head of a church that has built itself on SPOTUS, the denial of these Roman gods? Isn't that what they're all about? Right? And yet, everything is a statue. Everything's a statue. And I didn't go into the churches, which is actually, according to most authorities, prohibited, right? But within the churches, don't they have statues of God, God's mother, God's mother-in-law, the whole world, everything, right? What's going on? The answer is, they took some Jewish concepts and they diluted it because the average person couldn't conceive of God if they couldn't see. Right? They're not philosophers. They were not Jewish enough. Right? These people, the ancient Romans and the ancient Christians and the Europeans, they have a problem. Right? They were not enough of a philosopher to be Jewish. A real monotheist, you've got to be a little bit of a philosopher. You've got to be. Right? To be a real monotheist, you've got to be able to, monotheist, to believe in this one God. You cannot have images. We don't have statues. We don't have human faces. We don't have all that. Right? Because we deny that that is part of God. God doesn't have an image. He doesn't have a physicality. He doesn't have a body. He's beyond that. He's not even spiritual. He's beyond any description and any definition. To understand that and to believe in that, Jews got to be a little bit of philosophers. That's where even the popes failed. Right? The great people, they failed in that. Right? And they're still building images and this and that statue, that very beautiful artwork. I don't deny the artistic value of it, right? But I do say that what it shows is that they didn't make it in terms of emunah. They did not make it. Whereas a Jewish child does make it, right? And that's a central part of Judaism. So Nachmanides, as I started by saying, at the end of the parasha says that that is the ta'am, the mitzvot rabot, the reason of many mitzvot is this idea of to instill in us a relationship with God. I had a member of my congregation in Toronto had a problem with alcohol, right? I suggested that he go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said to me, he says, I can't go to them. They're Christian. I said, no, they're not a Christian group, right? He said, yes, they are. I said, why do you say they're Christian? He says, because they talk about God all the time. Now, that's a little sad, isn't it? Why is it sad? Here he is, a Jewish guy who goes to a synagogue in the neighborhood, right? And he thinks that an organization is Christian. Why? Because they're talking about God all the time, right? That means that in the synagogue, right, what did it mean? They weren't much talking. There's not much talk about Hashem. There's talk about everything else, but not about a relationship with Hashem, right? So there's a little bit of a gap. Remember, you don't have the relationship. When you just have the external structure and you don't have the inner relationship, the external structure can fall away. In fact, we believe, the Reb Chaim Volozhin points this out. He says, the temple, how could the temple be destroyed by the Romans? He says, the answer is the Jews must have destroyed the inner temple in order for the Romans to be able to destroy the outer temple. Right? I mean, can you imagine that? The Romans, pagans, right? Rishaim, evil people. Used to have their entertainment by seeing people ripped apart by animals in the Colosseum. Right? These people carrying the menorah out of the temple? These people, how could they do that? The answer is, what they destroyed was already destroyed. In fact, the Talmud says, a voice from heaven came down. When Titus was destroying the temple, a voice from heaven came down and said, Kemach tachun tachanta. Which means, Titus, you are grinding ground flour. What that means is the temple was already destroyed. It looked, you could see it, it looked very nice. The stone was silver, but the inner kedusha, the inner sanctity, we destroyed it first. By sucking out the kedusha, so to speak. Once we destroyed the inner temple, it was already kemach tachun, it's ground flour. Now Titus, he's destroying something which is just a shell. Just a shell. And a shell is very vulnerable if there's nothing inside it. Nothing inside it. Diaspora Museum in Tel Aviv, where I had the students there, right, they've got a whole display of Jerusalem stones and the Arch of Titus, right, the signs on them, don't touch the stones. Everyone touches the stones. Because when you touch the stones, you find they're polystyrene, they're empty, right? They look like stones, but they're empty. You could punch your fist through them, right? They're empty. So that is, if the mitzvot are devoid of emunah, If they are devoid of our relationship with God, if they're devoid of these ideas, then to a certain degree they're like hollow. And if they're hollow, then the media, right, and Richard Dawkins, and your college professor, and your next door neighbour, and anyone can punch a hole through it. It's very, very vulnerable. Very vulnerable. And when it's, and because it's empty. So the second area is the emptiness of Emunah. We're not familiar with that. I think there's a third idea as well, which is depth. People very often are not used to looking at things in depth, meaning we may have looking at the Torah in depth. I mean, we're very often satisfied with explanations which are superficial, which don't necessarily fit in, and which don't have depth to them. We often look at things and only look at them on the surface, right? To a great degree, Maharal of Prague was very, very upset about this. The Maharal spoke about this at great, great length. The idea of people not using their intellect as much as they should when it comes to Judaism and comes to the Torah, right? We put out, you know, we might be involved in some profession where we have to really exert ourselves intellectually, and yet when it comes to Judaism, we don't exert ourselves intellectually. We may have for a year or two when we were in advanced yeshiva, and then after that, it's over. Intellectual exertion. He gives a fascinating example. He says you have two scholars, two people who know how to learn Torah, right? And they both want to know what is the law in a particular case. He says one of them looks in a shortened book, like a short book, like an abbreviated book, what he calls Sefer Kitzurim, an abbreviated book. The two examples he gives are Rambam, Maimonides, and the Tur. Right? To us, those are already not Kitzur anymore. But anyway, he says, person looks it up in the index, he gets the right answer, and now he knows what the law is. He says the other person doesn't do that. The other person researches the topic, looks into all the sources, learns through all the sections of the Talmud about it, and he comes out with a conclusion, and he's wrong. He says, which one is more beloved to God? The Maharal says the second. Because the first one, even though he got the answer right, he avoided the pathway of the intellect. He did not exert himself. He did not invest himself. He took the shortcut. And the shortcut is, he says, it was without Darkei HaSeichel. So without Darkei HaSeichel, without the intellect, that person is losing a tremendous part of Judaism. So we have to look into that, and that's something which we have to do, to intellectual exertion, also in the Torah. In the, you know, a good friend of mine just wrote a book. His name is David Foreman. The book is called The Beast That Crouches at the Door. It's a fascinating book. And one of the things he points out is, very often we learn the Chumash, we learn through the Torah. The problem, he says, is called the elephant in the room. You ever heard of that issue? The elephant in the room? What is the elephant in the room? People are in a room, there's an elephant in the middle of the room. And one person is looking and saying, why is there a scratch in the wall there? And there's another person saying, and look at that, the floorboards are dented. Right? And another person is saying, there's not much light in here. And they're all looking at these things all around, and hello, there's an elephant in the room. And no one's looking at the elephant. It's like they're ignoring it. So he says, very often we look at a section of the Torah, right, like Bereshit, right, whatever sections of the Torah, right, and there's a huge issue, an elephant in the middle of the room, in the middle of the parsha. And instead of looking at the elephant in the middle of the parsha, right, what we're doing is that word, and we're going in the peripheries of it. Right? We're not going to the center of it. Right? So he says one of the things you're supposed to do, and this is the commentaries do, is they look at the elephant in the middle of the room, the big questions, the things that really are essential and central to the parasha, which we very often miss, because I'm looking at a gematria here and looking at, oh, isn't it cool how the end of each word makes the name of this and this and this, and that's it, and I've missed the central point. So it's intellectual exertion in Torah, which is also something that we are missing to a great degree. I think also this is problematic, because if I don't have that, I don't feel like I'm a partner. And we believe that in the Torah, in our relationships with the Torah and Judaism, we should not just be passive recipients. We are supposed to be partners with the Torah. We are supposed to create Torah. Each person has a unique perspective of Torah. You know, very, very interesting. A question which is asked by the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. He asked the following question, that on when do we celebrate the giving of the Torah? Which festival celebrates the giving of the Torah? Shavuot. Correct. Shavuos. When the Torah was given on Sinai, it was Shavuot. That's when we celebrate. When do we dance like crazy with the Torah scrolls? Simchat Torah, right? He says, doesn't make sense. Wouldn't it be more logical to dance like crazy on Shavuot? That's when the Torah was given. So what do we do on Shavuot? We eat cheesecake and we learn all night, which is very nice, right? Especially the cheesecake, right? We eat cheesecake, we learn all night, right? And on Simchat Torah, we dance around with the Torah. We dance for hours and hours. We sing till our throats are hurting, right? Unbelievable. And yet Simchat Torah is a much later, I mean, there are sources in the sages, in Chazal for Simchat Torah, but it's basically the finishing of our reading of the Torah and the beginning of the cycle once again. So he asked, what's going on here? Right? It appears that it's a much more significant was the giving of the Torah than the fact that we read the Torah through the course of the year. So his answer is the following. His answer, he said, because you see on Shavuot, we were passive recipients of the Torah. We received it. He says on Simchat Torah, when we read the Torah, we're not passive recipients. What are we? Active partners. We are doing the reading of the Torah. We created the custom, right? We created the idea that we should read the Torah. And we read the Torah with a much greater celebration. There's much greater celebration when you're an active participant than when you're a passive recipient. And that is a major part of what we are missing as well. We are to a great degree passive recipients of Torah, passive recipients of the mitzvot, passive recipients as opposed to active partners. An active partner is one who feels that I have a stake in this, that I am part of this. Right? And that's where, and when you have that, it's a totally different situation. Totally different. Number four, I think we're up to number four. Number four is is another area we have to focus on, and this is something neglected as well, is simcha. Happiness. Right? That is to say, simcha, happiness in doing the Torah, happiness in fulfilling the commandments, happiness in learning the Torah. That's something which is very, very, very central. You know, I've met with a lot of kids and a lot of adults who've left Judaism. One of the most common features that I found them complaining about, you know what it was? They didn't enjoy Shabbat at home. They didn't enjoy the festivals. There was not a lot of simcha. Their father was very often so tired from the week, he'd be sitting there falling asleep doing an Elvis in the soup, right? And their mother is exhausted from preparing, right? And the parents are sitting there saying, sit at the table. You ever seen a parent do that? Sit at the table, stay here, right? Usually, the benefit of sitting at the table is so that the guests can see your child at the table, not for the benefit of the child, right? Let the kid, like, he's a little kid, he has to sit at the table for 2 hours while you're talking about whether Obama will beat Clinton or something. I mean, the kid's not, right? I mean, Nebuch, the poor kid, right? He's 11 years old. He's not interested, right? If it's interesting for him, and if the conversation is directed at the child's level, and if he's an active participant, and if there is simcha, then he will stay at the table anyway. But if he's to stay at the table because I've duct taped him to the chair, right, so the guest will see how well behaved my child is not going to do much for the child's future in Judaism. Right, the feeling of simcha, the feeling of happiness and the feeling of joy is something, you know, people, Jews for centuries took pride and took joy in everything. This is Roman pride, fresh on my mind, so I just got to mention this as well. I was in the museum, the Jewish Museum in Rome, has one of the most magnificent collection of Torah scroll covers I've ever seen. Hundreds of the most beautiful fabric covers of, I don't know if George, you have the solid ones or the Ashkenaz style?
Both,
excellent. Okay, so they have these beautiful fabric covers of the Torah scroll. Beautiful. And why do they have so many of them? One of them was very strange. One of them was made of this beautiful fabric and it had the royal crown of Sweden all over it. So I asked the curator of the museum and she said, very simple. From 1555 to 1870, the Jews, by papal order, were confined into the ghetto in Rome. They had to live in the ghetto. And the Pope, right, ordered they could only engage in two trades. Money lending, which was something which was an evil sin for the Christians, but the Jews could do it. Right, and trading in old clothes. So the Jews traded in old clothes. But you know what they did with the finest ones that they traded? They took the finest ones, the most beautiful ones, and they made them into beautiful Torah scrolls. And there was a princess from Sweden who had lived in Rome and died in Rome. And the Jews acquired some of her royal gowns. And out of the most beautiful one, they made a scroll, they made a cover for the Torah scroll, which has got the crown of Sweden on it. Right? It's a beautiful thing. Jews took pride and joy in the Torah. I remember Sir Jonathan Sacks, chief rabbi of England, once mentioned that, you know, he has a relationship. There's a, I forgot which who it was. I don't know if it was the Archbishop of Canterbury. It may have been. They both actually go for the same football team, the same soccer team. They're both fans of the same soccer team. They're actually at a soccer match in England, Chief Rabbi Sacks and the Archbishop. And they're in this VIP box, and supporters of the particular team, I think it's Arsenal, right, said to them, give us a blessing, give us a blessing. So anyway, the chief rabbi and the archbishop both blessed the team. Anyway, their team lost. So to the disappointment of the fans, there was an article in the newspaper the next day which said basically that evidently God does not listen to the prayers of either the archbishop or the chief rabbi. So the chief rabbi wrote back, he says, evidently God's not a fan of Arsenal. But anyway, the archbishop once commented to Sir Jonathan Sacks, once commented to him, and he said, Judaism is so full of laws, it's so legalistic and dry. He says, where's the passion? Where's the love? And Rabbi Sacks said to him, don't you also have laws of the church? He says, of course we do. He says, do you have books of canon law, of church law? And the archbishop said, of course we do. He said, and your congregation, when they come to the Canterbury Cathedral, he says, are they aware the books are there? He says, yes, I'm sure they're aware of it. He says, do they ever take the books out of the cupboards, hug them, kiss them, and dance around with them like maniacs? And the archbishop said, of course not. So the rabbi said, where's the passion?
Where's the love?
Where's the love? He says, we do it all the time. He says, when we take our book of law out of the ark, people hug it and kiss it. He says, numerous times during the year, you know, we take a Torah out, you know what we do with it? We dance with it. We dance with it. Like a bride and groom dancing. He says, once we take it out, we have Simchat Torah. We bring a new Torah to a synagogue. We dance it there. He says, there's passion and there's love. We love the Torah and we have a passion for it. And it's something which gives us simcha, something that gives us joy. That's something, so we have a few things that as some of us here are parents, all of us, God willing, will be parents, right? And certainly for ourselves and for our children, I think there are a few things we have to focus on. Number one, the idea of bechira, of choice, meaning. That we have to understand that, yes, I choose to do this, and it's something which I want to do, and it's something which is not automatic, but it's something which I think about, right? Number one. Number two, that there is a partnership between me and God, between us and God and the Torah. We think about the commandments. We do them with passion. We do them with happiness. We do them with joy. The emphasis on joy, emphasis on happiness. All these things, I think, are essential to stop the bleeding and the hemorrhaging from the Jewish community. I don't have, you know, for the schools, I don't know if there's anything I can do about it, but what we can do within our homes, what we can do within our communities is to emphasize these ideas. Very, 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 very central. The idea of emunah, these are things that we don't study enough. Sometimes we don't study at all. Areas of emunah. There are books out there like the Kuzari, Rabbi Yudah Halevi, which is an argument and a beautiful discussion of Jewish faith, which is a very accessible book. It's translated into many different languages. There are many books like this. There are many books out there. Here is one area where the world of outreach and the world of inreach join. Because how do people attracted to Judaism? One of the ways people are attracted to Judaism is because of the emunah, because of the passion, because of the joy. Gateways, we have seminars once a month. So I remember we used to do seminars at a hotel in New Jersey. and the events manager at the catering manager at this hotel was Jewish, but she was not at all involved in. I mean, she was the event manager at this hotel in the middle of New Jersey somewhere, and she eventually started coming to classes at the seminars. And now she is observant. She quit her job because she couldn't keep Shabbat and keep that job. And she's now working somewhere else. Her son goes to a yeshiva high school. And she is an observant woman. And of course, I asked her, what was it that brought you to think it was, did you overhear a class? Right? Was it what? She said, no. You know what it was? She said it was the Malava Malka. The Malava Malka. Saturday night, we have a celebration. We have a band. And we dance. And we have food out, and people have a great time, and we sing. She said, she's the event manager at the hotel. She runs weddings and sweet 16s and graduation, stuff like that. She said, common factor, alcohol, sometimes drugs. Usually there's fights, right? The behavior is horrific. And she says she doesn't see people really happy at these things. She said, here we have this event Saturday night. There's no alcohol whatsoever. And she says the people seem happier than anyone she's ever seen, even at their wedding. It's an amazing thing. Isn't that beautiful? I mean, I think that was a beautiful, what we call Kiddush Hashem, the sanctification of God's name. You see the weddings, right, that go on at this hotel. And I've seen them because people are coming back, they're drunk, their wives are embarrassed because the guy's cursing. It's like horrific stuff, right? And here, Malava Malka, not a drop of alcohol. Except for the rabbis, obviously, but not a drop of alcohol, right? Beautiful, and great joy. So joy and happiness, very, very, very central. And so that's what attracts people to Judaism. And of course, the books of Emunah that talk about our belief and the centrality of our belief and how true it is and so on and so forth are things which I think people within the community who are already committed need to focus on as well. That's anyway a little bit of an introduction to the topic, entering the fold and leaving the fold. I'm happy to take, I mentioned that I would be happy to take questions and answer questions on pretty much any topic, preferably Judaism, but I am open to other subjects. And if you have any questions, please feel free to ask them. I'll evade them, answer them as best possible, and not to humiliate you in public, right? No Jewish questions, please. Jewish questions, as defined by Malcolm Hoenlein. Jewish question is when a member of the audience stands up, gives his own speech at the end, but raises his voice slightly at the end of his speech so it sounds like a question. That's what you call a Jewish question. So two Gentiles are talking. One talks, the other listens, then they switch places. The other talks, the other one listens. Two Jews are talking, one's talking, the other one's just waiting. Doesn't matter what you said. I've got this to say, and that's, I mean, right, that's how it is. But other than that, I'm more than happy to take questions. Yes?
So you refer to the idea of this herd mentality that exists, obviously, probably not only in Judaism, but any kind of religious
natural
enclosure. What is the remedy? Because for one side, we are what we call the emunah, the belief, of the cloud, the tzibur. You need the minyan, you have to be with people, you cannot practice Judaism alone in the forest. So you have to be with people, so you have to dress in a certain way, you have to attend certain functions and religious observance, whatever. And from the other side, individuality is important, to be happy is important, to find uniqueness in the Torah is important. So how do you break that, assuming that the person also has a natural inclination to follow the herd and not to be individual and not stick out his neck at any given time at fear of being judged or somehow looked.
Understood. So you've got a tension between two areas. The fact is that we are part of a community.
Please repeat the question.
The question was that there's a tension between the fact that on the one hand it is natural for people to want to be part of a community. That's normal. People are gregarious. If you're part of a group, you want to identify with a group and blend in with a group, and that's a very important part. And the truth of the matter is, as Maimonides says, a Jew who keeps all the commandments, who eats only kosher, who keeps Shabbat, but doesn't celebrate when the community celebrates, and doesn't mourn when the community mourns, and just stays off by himself, he says such a person is equal to someone who's abandoned Judaism. So you've got to be part of the community, and it's very, very important. Judaism is not an individual thing, it's a communal thing. But on the other hand, there's also the individuality. And that's very essential and very, very important. What you have to find is each person, the Kabbalists point out, that every person has an affinity to particular aspects of Judaism. Not to say that I can abandon every other aspect, but there are certain areas of Judaism which I have a particular feeling and affinity towards. Is that might be that my soul is particularly tied in with that particular mitzvah. And therefore, that's something maybe where my individuality comes out. You know, even if you're playing the same music, I remember I had a family that I know in Israel, and they no longer live in Israel, but they used to live in Israel, and they're all very musical, really musical family. I mean, like the mother is a PhD in music, she teaches piano, and one of the kids plays the drums, another kid plays the violin, another, it's unbelievable. So I'm sitting at their house with their 9-year-old son is there, and there's a CD playing. And it was a piece of Mozart, or Beethoven, I think it was Beethoven. And the kid says to his mother, he says, "Mummy, I was enjoying it." He says, "Mummy, can I please change the CD?" And I said, "Oh, rats, I was just enjoying this." So his mother says, "Sure you can, Josh." So Josh takes the CD out, rummages around the cupboard, puts another CD in. It's the same piece of music. The same piece of Beethoven. So I, the superior adult, said, "Josh, I think you just put the same CD back." He says, "No." He says, "The first one was the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. This is the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Zubin Mehta." It's totally different. I said, "Come here, I want to slap you." But you see, right, someone with an ear for music, right, they're playing the same instruments, they're using the same notes, but for someone who's sensitive, it's a different piece. And I feel it's a beautiful metaphor because even within halacha, and even within the fulfillment of the commandments, even when we have the same halachic or legal obligations, etc., etc., you know what? There's a tremendous amount of individual flavor. Guarantee. Reb Shlomo Carlebach making Kiddush Friday night was probably different from Reb Shach, which was probably different from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which is probably different than the Ger Rebbe, which is probably different from Avadji Yosef. Right? Probably they have the same amount of wine in the cup. They may have had the same type of wine, for all I know. They've probably got silver cups. The words they're saying, slight variations, pretty much the same words. Is it different? It's definitely different. It's as different as the Berlin Philharmonic and St. Martin in the Fields, right? Actually, it's probably a lot more different. Right? So a person has to find within the framework of halacha where your feeling is in these particular areas. Right? So that will be number one. Right? Number one is in terms of the smaller groups, that's why the Jewish people were originally created as 12 tribes, because there's also we all have an affinity to a different flavor and a different character and different aspect of Judaism. Right? All within halacha, but nevertheless very different. And that's where the different communities have massive differences. You know, you go to Rome and you hear the Roman Jewish prayers is going to be very different from Georgian. You'd listen to it, you'd think that's from a church. Right? And they'd listen to you and they'd think, "I don't know where it's from." I mean, right? Very, very radically different, right? So, but there's a beauty in the fact that there's an individuality. And even within the groups, each individual as a person has a different aspect of Judaism, which is something that catches their attention, so to speak, which their soul is more in tune with, and which I have to identify and I have to, so to speak, to fly with that a little bit.
An ability for me to choose Metallica as my preference of music, does it make me more capable of choice between the minor and major in the same Beethoven?
It's what you are.
Well, you see, it has to be tutored intuition. Meaning, right, there's a level of the intuition and it is going to be accompanied by a knowledge of Torah. So you have to study Torah, you have a mentor as well, right? And so yeah, it may not help you in the Beethoven choice, right? But if you're into Metallica, that tells you something about the type of music that you'd be more into. Right, so I'm saying within Judaism, it's also like that. Obviously, a person who's totally ignorant of Judaism, to start off his own particular style, etc., is silly. right? Because he doesn't even know the parameters of the framework. So you've got to have knowledge as well. You need a mentor, you need a rabbi, right? Aseilah Harav, as it says in Ethics of the Fathers. But once you have that, even within that, there's certainly room for the individual characteristics and personalities come out. And I think that's very, very important. We can't all be cookie cut. Schools, right, are designed to produce, mass produce, right? According to the Torah originally, there's no such thing as schools. How do you educate your children according to the Torah? No schools are mentioned in the Torah. What does it say in Shema? Teach your children. Right? Because in your teaching your own children, right, you can take the individuality into account. Right? But if your kid's in a class with 20, 30 kids, it's very difficult for that. So, but as adults, we have to take our own individuality into account. We can't be cookie cutters. Right? And you've got to have that ability to do so. So I think that's a very, very important part.
Because of the same Beethoven, that maybe the kids are leaving the fold.
I think so, certainly.
If that was the same Beethoven.
That's right.
How many versions you
play? I think that's part of it. I think people are all expected to be exactly the same. And no two people are going to be exactly the same. We say a blessing. If you see 600,000 Jews in one place, you say, Baruch Chacham HaRazim, blessed is God who is the master or the wise one of all the secrets. And it says, as their Keshen She'en Paratzufeyem Domim, Akach Ein Deoteyem Domim. Right? As their no two people's faces are exactly alike, so also their minds are not alike. And the truth of the matter is, even people whose faces are exactly alike, like identical twins, are their minds alike? No. Right, the individuals, there's a tremendous level of that. And that's something which is not emphasized, not understood enough. It's a big error when it comes to children. Right? When it comes to children, you know, I have two oldest boys, both of whom are in Israel now, very, very different, you know, in personality. One of them, there's an Israeli food called Krembo. Anyone know what Krembo is? It is a delicacy. It's a delicacy. It's one of the most greatest foods in the world. It is a very poor quality piece of biscuit with very pathetic quality cream covered by very poor quality chocolate, right, about that high, and it tastes awesome. Right, and there are different methodologies of eating Krembos. I'm sure you're all aware of that. There's been surveys done on whether you eat from top down or whatever. Anyway, so my two kids, one of them, the oldest one, he would eat, when age two, he did a Krembo, you couldn't tell it touched him. Immaculate. We used to call it the Immaculate Conception. The Immaculate Consumption, sorry. The Immaculate Consumption. Right, the other one, 2 years younger, he'd eat the Krembo, it would look like he'd been bathing at the Krembo factory. Right, covered in it. Right, they're very different. Now, my job as a parent is on the one hand to make sure that the kid who's the neat freak doesn't take it to an extreme. You know, so when we get invited to someone's house and he'd be sitting there looking at the cutlery, right, which is what he used to do, I'd have to try to control that. You know, just put it down, he says, but there's a spot on it. I said, doesn't matter, it's fine. And it's not parallel and stuff like that. But we've got it, you know, but on the other hand, I want to develop that component of him with a good aspect of it, right? You want to develop that individuality. I don't want to turn him into the other kid. Right? And the other kid, who's the one who's like, yeah, big deal, right? You know, and he's like covered in cranberry. On the one hand, there's a good component to that, which is not being too uptight about stuff. On the other hand, I want to impress upon him the importance that the clothes don't actually walk themselves to the laundry basket, right? They do develop enough organisms that they eventually can walk to it, but generally we'd like to put them in the basket before they do that. So as a parent, I'm trying to, so each one has his own individual makeup, and that's important for me to do, to involve, and that's true with myself as well, right? Areas of the self, right, which need to be reined in, I have to rein in, but on the other hand, not to the point of totally suppressing my individuality. I have to express that as well. That's very important. And I think, yeah, there are people who are not feeling that. There are people who are feeling oppressed and pushed into the particular model that that's not who they are. Right, and the truth is interesting. Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch, he says the reason God made 12 tribes originally, he says, because Judaism, he says, to show us the lesson that to serve God, you could be a scientist, a soldier, a politician, or maybe not. Okay, but you could be a storekeeper, you could be a physician, you could be a rabbi, you could be a scholar. He says all of them, because the 12 tribes were all of those things. Right, so every single one of those could serve God in their own way, right? Even within halacha today, right, to a certain degree, the emphasis of education is such that No, you've all got to be like each other, right? And that's not a good thing. Not a good thing. So you don't have to fight it. But as a parent, you don't have to fight it. But what you have to do is, the way you fight it is not by going straight against the school, because that's also not good. But rather it's by at home bringing out the individuality of the child. By at home being able to nurture that. That's where you have to do it. Right? Because the fighting with the school is not healthy either. Right? So what you have to do is give much more emphasis to what Revolvi calls Zriya aspect of education, which is the growth aspect of causing their particular flowers to grow, rather than the Binyan aspect, which is the structure aspect. So, you know, you have to do that a bit. That's the obligation. But I'm not only talking about with our children. I'm talking about with ourselves as well. That's the important thing. Sorry, anyone else? Yeah.
Let's say you have a relative who is going to be bar mitzvah soon, but they go to public school. And they want to have a bar mitzvah, but they don't know what the concept is of a bar mitzvah. In other words, they emphasize one night or day celebration, but not the rest of the days of their lives, of the young adult. What is the best way to get them or the child
involved,
or to see the light, for lack of a better
expression? Very difficult. I would say that one thing is would be to offer to prepare the child for bar mitzvah, but forget reading the Torah. Let's do a project. Let's do a project and find, right, 10 bar mitzvah boys throughout Jewish history, right, and learn about them. Or let's do a project and find one mitzvah, 13 mitzvot, right, and look at the different mitzvot. Some type of thing where you study with him once a week. Not too heavy stuff, not too heavy, something that you could do with a 13-year-old. And say, you know what, this would be a great thing. Do a project for your bar mitzvah of kindness, of chesed, right? Why don't we go and let's visit the sick once a week. Let's work at it, go to an old age home once a week. Let's do something, right? See if you can join up with some community in Israel. In other words, something where they're actually doing something of value as opposed to just learning to read the Torah, which they don't really understand, they don't know, right? They're going to mess it up, you know, anyway. Not that anyone in the shul is going to listen, right, etc. But, you know, that type of something meaningful out of it. That's the best you can do, I think. And then maybe you can continue after that. Yeah.
I had a question. It actually pertains to what you were just talking about right now with developing your own sense of self and not necessarily being spearheaded into what somebody else wants you to be. You also, earlier in your lecture, you made a very beautiful reference to the importance of showing simcha with everything that you do and how one of our holidays, Simcha Torah, is about taking reference to it as being similar to the happiness that's between the bride and the groom on their wedding night. My question is, in the Orthodox community, they're very strict with certain things, one of the things being dancing among men and women.
Mm-hmm.
When you made the reference to happiness between the similar to the bride, what a bride and groom experience on their wedding night to the Simchat Torah, why is it then, if happiness is so important and that's a portrayal of it, why is it that a night of the wedding for a bride and groom, they're not allowed to dance together?
You're referring to the fact that women don't dance with the Torah scroll, right? So, correct?
No.
Oh, the actual bride and groom, or
actual bride and groom?
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, well, the main reason for that is a matter of modesty. Right, modesty is a very, very important aspect here. There's two components to that. Component number one is intimacy between a man and a woman is something which should be kept for private. So that means the fact that a man is allowed to dance with a woman, right, is because he's married to her and she's married to him. In other words, the fact that they can be physically in contact, physically intimate, is a very, very precious and central component, and therefore that's something which should be preserved for the privacy of their home, right? So therefore, that's not done in public, number one, right? The second reason is, in general, for the modesty of the woman to be dancing in the presence of men watching her dance, right? Which, if she'd danced with the chatan, that would be the situation, is also problematic in terms of that. So the main component there is the idea that the preciousness of that relationship is something which we like to preserve for something which is private. That's basically the idea. You know, it's type of interesting, in the Western world, to a great degree, the concept of modesty is looked at as a sickness. What I mean by sickness, people say you've got a body image, you've evidently got a body image problem. I don't have a body image problem, right? I have a sense of dignity and modesty, right? So I point out to people that you know, animals, for example, have no sense of modesty or dignity because they're animals. The reason we have a sense of modesty and dignity is because we have an neshama, we have a soul. In fact, one of our great commentaries, Rav Zrachya Halevi, he says, "Hanashama, hanefesh nikrait kavod." Another word for soul is kavod, which means honor or respect. So it's certain. So there's a certain level at which we have a tremendous, tremendous dignity and respect for certain things, and the things which are most holy are kept for most private. That's the basic reason. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, and for braving the weather. I appreciate your coming, and thank you.